Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Keval Ramani, and today I have the pleasure of hosting Anant Krishnan on this podcast. Anant is a journalist with the Hindu newspaper based in Chennai today, but he's actually reported from China for a very long period of time. He's in fact one of the handful of Indian journalists who've actually lived in the country and covered it. He's also been a fellow at the Asia Global Institute in Brookings, India. And that ties in with the conversation today, which will largely focus on a new paper that Anant has published with Brookings. The paper is titled Follow the Money, China Inc.'s Growing Stake in the India-China Relationship. It documents the expansion of business and Chinese business interests in India and recommends a set of measures for the government to adopt. Anant, firstly, congratulations on the paper and welcome to All Things Policy.
Thank you so much for having me.
Anant, before I get into the paper, I just want to go back to sort of your years in China. I want to first ask you, when was it that you first went to the country? What took you over there? What was your initial experience like? And a little bit, if you can share with me about your view on how the Indian media tends to cover China.
Sure. So I moved there to report for the Hindu first in 2009. And then I ended up staying on and reported for India Today starting from 2014 onwards. So I was there for a combined period of around 9 years. And to be fair, I went in without much understanding of the place. I did a few months of language training. I spent a few months in Shanghai to prepare myself. But then, as you know yourself, I think getting familiarized, especially with the language, is, I think it's a lifelong endeavor. In terms of how the media covers it, I think one of the big challenges is that we have a very limited number of Indian media organizations that have journalists posted in China full-time, and I think that's a huge problem. When I first moved there in 2009, there were just four of us. Besides me for the Hindu, there was somebody from the Press Trust of India, PTI. There was Times of India and Hindustan Times. And Manoj, believe it or not, 11 years on, that's exactly the same number. There's four correspondents, plus last year we had somebody who was posted for Doordarshan and AIR. So we just have five people. And I think it's really a shame that you don't have regional media organizations that are based there. You only have English language media that are based there. And I think the other big issue is television media doesn't have a presence there at all. Yeah. And I think that you and I know that, I mean, China has covered quite a lot on Indian television, often by people in their studios. And I think it really hurts the quality of coverage when you don't have people who are there on the ground.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it really, I teach a course in China, and when I sort of talk to people about Belt and Road, and sort of it strikes them when I say things like, I can see why sitting in Delhi, you may have this sense of, you know, being encircled. But if you actually go and look at it from the point of view of what's being said over there, what's being done, it's a far different dynamic. So, you know, your perspective changes depending on where you're sitting and how you're going to look at it. So it's really useful if you're actually there to see how things are functioning.
No, right. I completely agree. And I think it's a problem. And this is one thing I'm not exactly sure how we are going to go about fixing this. And it is a bit of an issue in the sense that I think you may have also seen the trend of I think China has actually been quite proactive in getting foreign journalists to come over to China and report from there. And they are, in fact, taking the initiative and funding it. But that opens all sorts of questions for us in the sense that, are we coming to a situation where we're going to have Indian reporters who are based in China purely because the Chinese government is hosting them? And obviously, that's going to impact the kind of coverage they can do. Yeah. And the reason China is doing it is obviously because it sees an interest in shaping the global narrative on how China is reported. So I think for me, it is a big concern, both in terms of our own understanding, in terms of what's happening on the ground in China, but also this newer problem of China sort of being the only actor that's taking the initiative in deciding how it's being covered, even abroad.
Yeah, Yeah, no, fair enough. I totally get that. Okay, so we're going to pivot from the media and we're going to talk about the paper. So you've essentially done a broad sweep. I mean, I was reading the paper and I was like, it's really exhaustive. You've done a broad sweep of all major sectors where there is Chinese investment in India. Firstly, I wanted to sort of get to know what sort of drove you to look at this point of time, and how challenging was it to get this data? Because as you've highlighted in the paper, there's very little information, and even if there is information, it doesn't capture everything that governments have. So how did you go about capturing the data? And firstly, what drove you to actually look at this initially?
Right. So I had the idea of wanting to do something on this when I moved back. I finished my term with India Today in August 2018. And I got this great chance to spend a year as a visiting fellow with Brookings India, which is a think tank that's headquartered in New Delhi. So I had 11 months with Brookings India. And the idea was that while I would keep writing op-eds and columns, but I would also work on doing a research project. And I thought this was something that needed to be done, because for me, I'd heard like by word of mouth that there was a lot of movement of Chinese companies coming into India, of Chinese people in India. And I could see that firsthand every time I took a flight from Chennai to Delhi, for example. I would, like, it surprised me that I would actually hear Mandarin being spoken at the airports. And this wasn't the case a few years ago. And I think we focus a lot on trade figures and the trade deficit, but I had the feeling that the scale of Chinese investment in India had kind of gone under the radar. And I thought it would be a useful exercise to kind of try and map it. But then the question that you asked me is the most important one in terms of the data. Just to give you a sense of how difficult it was, so I started working on this. I spent August and September 2018 just meeting people in the government and elsewhere, trying to get a sense of the lay of the land. Who are the big players? How do you go about figuring out what they're doing? But just putting together this 30-page paper, I mean, it came out in March 2020. So it took me a year and a half working on and off to get this done, which gives you a sense of how difficult it was. And as I kind of try and stress right in the introduction, the idea is not to provide a definitive figure of how much Chinese money there is. I think that's, I didn't have the wherewithal to do that. I think this is just the first attempt in trying to map out how much money there is. But I think people with the resources, and especially people who have the finance background, if you're listening to this, I encourage you to make a fist of it and try and be more precise than I was, since I kind of approached this more as a reporter rather than someone who has the financial brains and tools to really forensically map out how much money there was and where it was. So I really, I'm upfront about saying this is just a first attempt and I think people can improve on it. But the idea is just to kind of present a picture of how this has kind of rapidly expanded without really people paying too much attention to it. And I think that raises all sorts of questions in terms of our policy in dealing with China as well.
Yeah, the figure that you've sort of come up with essentially is that, and like you said, this is an estimate, and this is, you know, there could be much more, there could be much lesser, and where it's, you're sort of encouraging others to look at it. But the figure that you've sort of looked at is approximately $26 billion planned and current and planned investment. And that's a huge amount. I mean, the one figure that I remember constantly hearing over the last year or so is about technology investments being at about 8 to 9 billion. But this sort of is 26 billion and is an estimate of across different sectors, including construction, real estate, you know, all sorts of other things. The other question that I had in this context was, you also said that this investment is fundamentally different from the way the relationship was, say, before 2014. And you marked that as a sort of turning point in some ways. That in 2014, before 2014, in some ways, this relationship was fairly, the economic relationship between India and China was fairly transactional. Firstly, I'd like you to explain what you mean by the transactional relationship. And then talk to us about how this has changed and what has this changed exactly.
Right. So I think the kind of Chinese companies you had in India from the early 2000s were basically doing project contracting. You don't really need to establish a permanent office or a presence. You had people coming in, doing things and leaving in power or even in telecom. And so you had project contracting and you also had equipment sales. So the big sort of incentive for Indian companies was basically this was cheap equipment. And there was absolutely no infrastructure in terms of having, for example, after-sales servicing. Or, for example, if you bought a big piece of machinery for a power plant in North India from China, you could have used it for a few years. It was cheap. But if it went kaput, you would have nowhere to go to fix it. But it was an arrangement that suited both parties only because for Indian companies, there was a huge benefit in getting this cheap equipment, especially in telecom. And I think a lot of it was a big factor in explaining how fast we were able to expand our telecom sector throughout the 2000s was this cheap equipment that was coming in. And so I think basically one consequence of this is that India is basically buying a lot of stuff. Chinese companies are happy to sell it, but they don't really have an incentive to establish themselves in the Indian market or to really become stakeholders in the Indian market. So I think that was how the relationship generally was. And what changed in 2014? Obviously, we had a change of government in India, so people might peg it to that. But I think rather than that, I think it was more a result of what was happening in China from 2013 onwards, where you had this huge surge of Chinese investment going abroad, not just to India, but all over the world. And India happened to be one of the places that was attracting it. So I think that's why we started seeing this change in 2014. I think it's explained as much by changes that were happening in China's own economy, rather than just the change in government that we had here, which is what I think many people will assume when you fix 2014 as a turning point.
The other aspect of this is that you speak about the influence of new actors in Chinese foreign policy making. And this sort of ties into the fact that there's a large amount of investment from China sort of going out into the world in different parts of the world. And you speak about the rise of sort of different actors. So state-owned enterprises have always been influential, but now you've got provincial governments who have grown in significance. And this has happened over time, not just necessarily since 2014. And you've got the private sector also, which is becoming increasingly influential. Talk to us a little bit about, firstly, these new actors and what sort of, I mean, it's quite an opaque system to figure out as to what exact influence anybody has. But just a sense of how are these different actors molding foreign policy and what sort of sense do you have of that? And secondly, we'll get into a little bit about this distinction between private and state in China, which given everything over Huawei over the last couple of years has become one of those hot debates around the world.
Right. No, I think it's a very difficult question to answer only because, as you rightly put it, it's such an opaque system. I think of the new actors, I think I find the private sector to be the most interesting only because you really quite don't know what position and they occupy in the scheme of things. I think that often I hear the argument, especially even from people in India, including in our tech sector, who are getting money from Chinese private companies. They say, oh, why do you only flag the Chinese private sector and their relations with the government? It happens all over the world. Look at American companies that do things for their own government, for the Department of Defense, or whatnot. But I think people don't really quite understand how unique the Chinese private sector is and fundamentally different structurally from what you see in any other country in the world. And I think that if you look at big companies, you mentioned Huawei. One of the puzzling things with Huawei is I've spent so many years reporting about it and reading about it, but I still find it so difficult to understand its ownership structure, who decides what, besides the chairman, Ren Zhengfei. What kind of influence does the government have over Huawei's policy? It's something that I genuinely cannot give you a definitive answer to. And that's partly because of the opacity that you mentioned. But I think there's no doubt that the Chinese government finds the private sector as a useful tool in terms of advancing their own goals abroad. And in a way, they're playing a role quite similar to what the state sector was doing throughout the 2000s, when you had, for example, Chinese state companies going to Africa, Latin America, acquiring resources and doing big infrastructure projects. I think it's not exactly the same, but I think that's, as you rightly said, there's an opacity here that I think that people need to pay attention to.
In terms of sort of framing policies, because a lot of private sort of technology investments in Indian private sector, so whether it's, you know, Paytm, whether it's fintech, whether it's food technology, whether it's healthcare, a lot of this investment the issue around that has been about, well, okay, what's the sort of level of control does the investment give in terms of equity control within these companies? And secondly, what's the control with regard to data, where the data is stored? And a lot of this seems to be an issue of where we need to get our own internal sort of processes and systems and legislation in place to be able to have a framework to actually govern some of this stuff, as opposed to looking at just China. Would you sort of agree with that?
I completely agree with you 100%. And I think the way we can look at it, it's an India problem. It's not a China problem. I think it's up to us. I think we need to create the structures in place to ensure that no matter who comes, whether this is investment for tech startups or whether this is for 5G, frankly, it shouldn't matter whether it's a Chinese company or a Danish company. The idea is that we should have the structure in place to ensure that we are able to regulate what they're doing, and also that we have an investment environment that's transparent and predictable and doesn't single out a company because they're from X or Y country. And I make that point towards the end. And for me, it was a difficult line to walk because since I'm highlighting, my focus is on Chinese companies. So I think a criticism that I'm, which would be, people would be like, well, you're being alarmist because it's China. So I think that we need to walk a line between alarmism and being completely complacent and saying that, well, if we're getting money from the West, it's no different if we get money from China as well. But I think you hit the nail on the head. I think the question that we should be focusing on is how does India deal with this surge of money that's coming in? And I think that's where the focus of policymakers should be. And I think the other problem is the terms of, for example, the data question that you mentioned. I don't know. I mean, we have assurances from companies that data is only going to be stored in India. But I think that, frankly, for someone who's not in the tech world or on the inside, these are statements that we take at face value. We know there are close strategic relationships between many of the Chinese investors and the Indian companies they are working with. And quite frankly, I've been unable to get a good sense of the nature of how close these strategic relationships are. I think if you've been to China, one thing that really strikes me is I tried and failed to register as a Paytm user over the last 2 years because of apparently some limits that the RBI has put on them getting new users. But I was just so struck at how it's such a mirror image of the Alipay app. If you've used the Alipay app, in terms of the color, in terms of the services, in terms of the layout. So these are close relationships we're developing, and I think there's lots of benefits from these close relationships. There's a lot we can learn from how Chinese companies have done remarkable things in the tech space, and there's lots of benefits in terms of getting Chinese capital and investment to help us scale up. But at the same time, we should also focus and have some clarity on what are the checks and balances that are in place.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I'm going to sort of pivot further now. I did a report which I sort of, I was a head author of that report, and which was looking at essentially China's relationship with India. And we spoke about the need to expand paradiplomacy also. We spoke about the need for states and cities to develop sort of the, actually have relationships which are beyond what we already have in some ways. For example, from my calculation, we have about 7 pairs of sister cities between India and China and at least 2 pairs of sister provinces. But there's very little that's actually happening in terms of these sort of subnational government relationships. You also recommended that there should be much more in this, given that, and this is a striking figure in the report, in your paper, you talk about how 3 provinces account for much of the trade with India, right? Guangdong, Jiangsu, and Zhejiang. Tell us a little bit about where India, sort of where this approach by India is sort of falling short. Because there has been some effort, but it's not really where it should be, right?
No, you're absolutely right. I think there's a lot of initiatives, but in everything that we do, I think there's no follow through. And I think it's a problem on both sides. And I think state to province is a great example. You'd remember when Prime Minister Modi visited China in 2015, there was a lot of attention on setting up this state leaders forum. The idea was that you'd have state leaders and provincial leaders coming together and a forum for them to interact with. And I would really urge anyone to look at the speech that the Prime Minister gave at the opening of this forum in 2015, because he makes an excellent case for how, even though the relationship is kind of led out of Delhi and Beijing, The reality is that most of the nuts and bolts of engagement actually don't happen in Delhi or in Beijing. It happens in cities, and it happens in the states. And he made all the right noises, did the right thing. But then, as far as I understand, in 5 years, that was the first and only time you had the state and leaders for a meeting. It never happened since. And I think that we also find that both for Indian companies that go to China and Chinese companies that come here, assurances that they get in Beijing don't really matter. In India, it's self-evident that, say, if Delhi welcomes a company and says, please, we want your money, it doesn't matter a jot when they end up in the state and that they have to deal with the state government to get land. They have to deal with a whole range of issues, with labor issues, employment issues. And the success or failure of a Chinese company in India will be determined by the state government and not by Delhi. And you'd be surprised that the same thing works the other way around. We think of China as being so centralized, but at the end of the day, if the Ministry of Commerce in Beijing says something, it matters little. A provincial government in China has far more power than the Ministry of Foreign Affairs or the Ministry of Commerce. And you need these avenues to ensure that, for example, a company is going to be successful. And it's so important because so much of the bilateral engagement actually goes through these avenues that are being completely ignored. And these sister state, sister city relationships that are struck on paper, there are about a dozen of them, but very few of them have actually translated into tangible, concrete outcomes on either side.
Yeah, that's a challenge, right? And I mean, in your paper, you even highlight the fact that in terms of our sort of chambers of commerce and that sort of presence in India, we're very, very, in terms of that presence in China from India, it's there's only a CII presence from what I understand. And then there's an embassy presence in Guangdong where we're looking at some of these trade relationships. But there's not much, given that it's a massive country with so much to do.
No, that's right. And I've been struck by how other countries have really well-staffed operations in China. If you look at whether it's Australia or the US or Canada, in terms of the way their chambers of commerce function, they really are a model in the sense that they have legal teams that help companies. They lobby with the Chinese government. They lobby independently with Chinese companies. And they're really a very useful tool for firms. And I've obviously focused on what we are doing, but it's a two-way problem in the sense that Chinese companies that come to India are in many ways even more in the dark than Indian companies that are in China. And that's only because, to be honest, at least maybe it's changing now, but for much of the last 2 decades, China has been much more used to dealing with foreign investment and more foreign investment friendly than India has been. So in that sense, it's in many ways. But it is a two-way problem, though, of course, I'm focusing on India's own approach to China.
Yeah, I mean, one of the examples within in the paper that you've done is this, this park, this industrial park that's supposed to be built, which was supposed to be led by the automaker Peichi in Maharashtra. And that didn't really get off because of a lot of sort of regulatory and bureaucratic hurdles within Maharashtra. Am I correct with that?
That's right. And that's just one example. You have that with the Peichi park, the auto sector. And you've also seen that with some of the bigger real estate deals, for example, the big Wanda deal in Haryana, which was sort of touted as the biggest ever Chinese investment in India. I remember covering the signing ceremony in Beijing, and you had people, you had government representatives involved. They were saying this is a $10 billion investment. It was big news at the time, but absolutely nothing has materialized from that. And that was because I think Wanda had unrealistic expectations of what the state government would do for them. The state government wanted a stake in the project, which Wanda felt would impinge their decision-making, so it just fell through. And I think that if you had the avenues in place, the big issue was, I think, misplaced expectations from the start on both sides. And that's possibly because both went into the arrangement not being as informed as they should have been.
Yeah, I'm not going to go into too many of the cases that you pointed out, but there's lots of information in the papers. I want people to go and read it. There's lots of different sectors covered: infrastructure, consumer goods, automobiles, energy, real estate. So there's lots in there for people to chew on. My sort of last question, which is a meta question on these different cases, is that last year after the summit that we had, the informal summit in Chennai, you had, or at least what was called Chennai, but it was not really in Chennai. At the end of that summit, both governments came out with a statement about setting up this mechanism on trade with the finance minister, Nirmala Sitharaman, and Hu Chunhua from China, the vice premier. Those guys sort of leading this conversation. I'm certain that nothing has happened so far, given that it was set up, announced in late October, and since then, January, everything's on shutdown. But the central idea, one of the central ideas of that mechanism was that you would get Chinese investments in India that would help sort of boost Indian companies, Indian exports, and also sort of probably some degree of service trade, although that was largely about manufacturing. But in, say, in the case of Huawei, which has a center in Bangalore and it's an Asia center, so it services other parts of the world also. So the idea that Chinese investments in India could help Indian companies and India's exports to sort of increase, are we seeing any examples of that?
I think the forum, I mean, the mechanism that they announced was something that should be welcomed. And obviously, we are now in unprecedented, unusual times. So, I mean, I would forgive them the slack. I would give them the slack on this occasion only because, I mean, these things take time, and you had 2 months, and then we found ourselves in this very unusual, unprecedented situation. And I wouldn't hazard a guess in terms of what this means, just because we are in the middle of such an unknown period. But on the whole, I would say that the idea that was, I mean, the way they explained the need for the forum and the role that it would perform was something that seemed to me to be really smart. And if they do go ahead with what they said they had in mind, I think that it would be a great forum to kind of look at all these issues that have cropped up in different sectors. And one of the things that I kept coming back to in the paper was how so many things are piecemeal. You have different ministries dealing with their counterparts, but as far as India is concerned, there's no sort of overarching trade or investment strategy. And I think that really hurts us because on the one hand, you have people like Invest in India who are rightly focusing on getting Chinese investment in. And then you have the Ministry of Commerce and you have other government branches that are fighting for Indian companies trying to get market access. And these things are happening on a completely parallel track. And you would think that it would benefit us if we have some sort of coherence which is what China did. I'm not saying it's an entirely good thing, but China made it very clear that if you want your companies to come in, there are certain things that you need to do. And I mean, we should examine at some stage, can our different sections of government work together in pursuing our goals with China in a more coherent and unified way? And I think that having such a forum where you have different government bodies involved is a good start. But I would add, as a last note of caution, we aren't lacking, as I mentioned in the paper, we aren't lacking for the number of forums, trade groups, committees, joint working groups that we have in almost every aspect from railways to agriculture. We aren't lacking for a number of joint committees and working groups, but the bigger challenge is having follow through.
All right. Thank you so much, Anand. Thank you so much for talking to us. Thank you so much for all these insights. And I'd recommend everybody read the paper. There's lots of interesting data in there and there's lots of insights. Once again, Anand, thank you so much. And it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me. And it was a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com. or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.